Banned substances are persisting in dietary aids.
Do clinicians know which of their patients have central venous catheters?
What about vitamin D levels in various types of milk?
And which is more expensive, physician organizations owned by hospitals or owned by physicians?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 24th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, how about if we start this week with something that's gotten a lot of press? Of course, all of these in some way or another have gotten a lot of press, but the one I've seen a lot has been this issue of vitamin D levels in milk. That's from the Canadian Medical Association Journal. Gosh, seems like there's a lot of people switching to almond milk and soy milk and so forth instead of cow's milk, but it comes with a downside.
And by the way, why are they switching, Elizabeth?
Isn't that a good question? You can help me out with that one because I'm not sure.
Oftentimes, parents are concerned that their children are allergic to cow's milk. Now, unfortunately, cow's milk is fortified with vitamin D. So the question is, if parents choose non-cow's milk for their children, does it affect their vitamin D levels? And that was the question that this particular study attempted to answer. And they included over 2,800 kids between the ages of 1 and 6 years of age. And they assessed what kind of milk they drank, and then they measured vitamin D levels. Most of the children drank cow's milk, but about 1 in 6 drank non-cow's milk, and sometimes a combination of the two. Children who drank only non-cow's milk were at higher risk of having a very low vitamin D level. In fact, they were about 2.5 or 3 times more likely to have a very low level. And the more non-cow's milk the child drank, the more likely it was that their vitamin D level was low.
But what about sun exposure? I guess I would factor that into the whole equation too.
They didn't correct for sun exposure necessarily, but they did correct for skin pigmentation. Children that had darker skin pigmentation were more likely to have low vitamin D levels as well.
The thing that I would ask is, if we turn them all outside and made them run around for a while, would we end up with adequate vitamin D levels without worrying about what they're consuming in their diet?
This particular study didn't address it, but it's unlikely that you could replace the fortification in cow's milk just by sunlight alone.
I guess then the other thing that we need to think about here is, what's the hard outcome relative to low vitamin D consumption for children? And I don't think we know the answer to that one.
Several case studies have identified severe rickets from vitamin D deficiency in children who did not drink cow's milk and had not been taking vitamin D supplementation. Vitamin D is important in the formation of bone in these young kids. I guess what we should tell the parents is, if you're going to have your child drink non-cow's milk, one should consider using vitamin D supplementation to make sure that their levels are in the normal range.
So when you say that, then clearly parents are going to need to ask the pediatrician to measure that level in their children.
That's one way to address it. The other is to just give vitamin D supplementation, even at that young age.
Since we're talking about things that we consume, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. The continued presence of FDA banned substances in common things people consume.
This is a one-page report, so it's not this really lengthy study, but it has a pretty significant impact. The FDA initiates what are called Class 1 drug recalls when they're concerned that the products have a reasonable possibility of causing either serious adverse health consequences or even death. The FDA has used this Class 1 drug recall in an effort to remove dietary supplements that have been adulterated with pharmaceutical ingredients. And in fact, half of all the FDA Class 1 drug recalls over the last decade have involved dietary supplements that have been adulterated with banned pharmaceutical ingredients. A small group of investigators took 27 dietary supplements and tested them to see whether any of these banned substances were in them. And what they discovered was 2/3 of these 27 had products that had been banned for at least a year, and sometimes the products have been banned for 5 years or more. Sometimes there was more than one banned product in them as well. So this is really disturbing. I guess what I would like our listeners to know is, first of all, there's no evidence that these dietary supplements help at all in terms of reducing weight. Secondly, is if this study is representative, then quite a few of them are adulterated with substances that could be potentially harmful and even cause death.
Of course, this is something that we've reported on in the past, at least these banned substances with regard to helping people achieve weight control or weight loss. What would you say then to people who want to achieve that objective right now?
There are some approved medications that can help. It's usually done in conjunction with either behavioral modification or lifestyle changes as well. But these dietary supplements aren't regulated very well. And what can happen is many of these are manufactured overseas and they're distributed under two or three or four different names. It's unwise, it's unhealthy to take these dietary supplements.
We'll leave that one. Of course, we're going to hear more about it, especially with regard to expansion of FDA powers in order to start regulating some of these things, which at least I'm in favor of.
I'm totally in favor of it as well, Elizabeth.
Now let's start looking a little more at the business of medicine. Let's take a look again in the Journal of the American Medical Association at this idea that, wow, if MDs or hospitals own practices, what happens?
Hospitals are in the process of acquiring group practices, that is physician practices, and they're doing this in the hope that they can consolidate care and integrate care as well. And these integrated delivery systems are really quite the rage right now. And they go into the vocabulary of what are called accountable care organizations. And the thought is that by integrating care, it can actually reduce expenditures. On the flip side, the possibility is once the hospital acquires these practices, care could actually be higher. And so this study attempted to address that by looking at the total expenditures per patient in hospital-owned versus physician-owned physician organizations in California. So this is a study of over 4.5 million patients. About 118 of the 158 organizations they looked at, about 75% were physician-owned. They provided care for over 3 million patients, and the remainder were owned by either local hospitals or by organizations. And what they discovered is even after they adjusted for the different types of diseases and the severity of the diseases in the patients, that the local hospital-owned physician organizations, the expenditures were 10% higher than when the physicians owned it, and when it was multi-site, the rate was actually 20% higher. So hospital-owned physician organizations incurred higher expenditures. This is for professional, hospital, laboratory, pharmaceutical, and ancillary services altogether.
Wow. Isn't that fascinating? Because here we all thought these ACOs were going to be one of the answers to containing healthcare costs, and instead it looks like expansion. Is there any speculation in this particular paper on why the costs were higher?
They didn't drill down enough. They didn't drill down to say, well, gosh, were they performing more procedures or were they charging more per procedure? So we don't have that information. I think it highlights to me the fact that oftentimes we jump on these medical fads. And I'm going to call accountable care organizations a medical fad. Integrated care, coordination, collaboration, that's all important. But they were sold as a way of reducing costs without anybody ever studying it. So I think before we adopt things globally, we actually need to do a better job of investigating them either in pilot or smaller studies to see if our expectations are actually borne out.
Having said that, I guess I would also point out that ACOs are a fairly new player on the horizon. And I suspect that once this kind of data starts to be revealed, that people are going to attempt to get their arms around it and figure out why they're more expensive.
You're right. This brings up a lot of questions. But again, this is all the rage right now. And a lot of the reimbursement is based upon, are you part of an accountable care organization? Well, actually, what this says is it actually raises costs.
Once again, a moving target. We'll hear more about it. Finally, let's turn to something that I thought was a little bit distressing. Central venous catheters, when they're placed in somebody, gosh, an awful lot of physicians seem not to know that they're there. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine.
And central venous catheters are intravenous lines in which people can receive medications or have blood drawn from them. The downside is the longer they're in, the more likely are they to cause an infection or to actually have a blood clot form in the vein, what's called a thromboembolism. So we like to use them when they're necessary. When we no longer need them, as early as possible, we like to remove them. Well, obviously, to do that, you have to know whether your patient has one or not. So this was a simple study. The investigators looked at 990 patients cared for by 1,881 different clinicians. These could have been residents or interns or hospitalists or attending physicians. And after rounds, these investigators asked a simple question. They went down the list of patients and asked, does this patient have a central venous catheter or not? About a fifth of the patients did. A total of 21% of the clinicians interviewed were unaware of the presence of a central venous line. Well, obviously, if you don't know about it, you can't remove it.
Yeah, it seems like a pretty potentially problematic oversight, at least as far as I can tell from this seat in the bleachers.
The more patients you had, the less likely you were to keep track of it. The interns were better at it, and the residents were better at knowing. Currently, patients can have central venous lines not because the doctor ordered them, but sometimes because the nurse recommends them or a phlebotomy team. So it may be put in, the doctor not even be aware of it. The important thing is that we need to actually improve this.
And I guess this is just one more thing that patients themselves could probably pay a little bit of attention to and sort of agitate for, hey, are we going to get this thing out of here? Or are we leaving it in for some reason?
Yeah, and so I think as patients, whenever you receive a medication or procedure, I think it's fair to ask your physician or the healthcare providers, do I need this? And what do I hope to gain from it?
So on that note, I'm going to reveal that this week I'm going to talk about, in the blog, the vitamin D levels in various types of milk in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, a journal I've never featured before.
And in deference to our partner and longtime listener, Tom, who's a Canadian, I think that's a great idea.
Excellent. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.